to invite Reverend Greg Shute to our pulpit. We have enjoyed sharings from Greg for over 15 years now. He joins us regularly. He is presently the part-time pastor at Central Delaware and looking forward to retirement. Is that correct? All right. Greg, next month.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see so many of your smiling faces again, and some new faces. As I was leaving the house this morning, Mary, she said, "So is the same group as it's always been, or are there new people?" And I said, "Well, there's a few new people I see each time, but a lot of times it's the same old faces." Sorry. Last Sunday, May 5th, was the 200th anniversary of William Ellery Channing's sermon in Baltimore, May 5th, 1819. So I thought this would be a good, actually I did this in Dover last Sunday, so I thought you guys would appreciate, because we often talk about our origins, but not often enough and deeply enough. And how many of you read the Baltimore Sermon? It runs an hour and a half, so be patient. We're going to go through the whole thing word by word. It was a landmark in a number of different ways. And I did ask him, in your order of service, there are two websites at the bottom on the right. They're both UUA websites, and one is about a page and a half of a context of his sermon, and the other one is a marvelous, it's about a four-page abridged, updated language version, which you can read in less than an hour and a half. And I printed out, and what I want to share with you is several paragraphs. I'm just going to read four paragraphs out of that abridged version and sort of unpack that a little bit. But I want to start first by just helping contextualize what life was like in 1819 that he felt compelled to do this. And as we all know, you know, the early United States, the colonies before the Revolutionary War and during that whole era, there was a huge shift in the way of thinking. So many people, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, came to the United States for religious freedom, to be able to think differently, worship differently, and to leave behind a lot of the structures of society in the old world. And so what was often happening is there was a shift in the philosophy, as well as, you know, the birth of really a liberal religious tradition that was rejecting a lot of things. And it can be perhaps best exemplified by King's Chapel, which is the oldest Unitarian congregation in the United States in Boston. The congregation was founded in 1686. And after the Revolutionary War in particular, all of the standing order churches in New England, the congregational style churches, were having a hard time getting ministers to come. Anglican preachers from the Church of England, they didn't want to come over here to this wilderness. And so King's Chapel was having a hard time finding a new minister in 1786. And so they thought, well, what are we going to do? And so there was a gentleman in the congregation named James Freeman, who owned a library. He was very well educated, very outspoken. And so the church got together a committee and approached him and asked him if he would be their minister. And he hemmed and hawed and all for a while, and he said, well, thank you for that, but I don't believe in the Book of Common Prayer. Now, the Book of Common Prayer is the established book in the Anglican Church that includes all of the rituals, ceremonies, and words, sort of like our living tradition book here, for the church. And so the committee hemmed and hawed and said, well, we don't necessarily agree with it either, so let's rewrite it. And that reflects pretty much what was going on in a lot of church, not every church, but in the new country, but a lot of the churches were feeling that sense of freedom from the established order, and this desire to rethink it and recreate it. And so there was some friction building between one town and another town, and between factions within the same town. And it kind of came to a head in 1805 when Henry Ware was elected president of the Divinity School at Harvard, because people recognized that the ministers who were coming out of Harvard ever after were going to be of this new ilk of these heretical thinking people. And so there was it kind of continued to build, and it became known as the Unitarian Controversy, which you probably have heard that term bandied about. And so William Channing, he got tired of being called a Unitarian, that's with a small u, which was referring back to one of the earliest heresies that we all know goes back to the Nicene invention of the Trinity. And he said, okay, rather than feeling denigrated by that term, let me tell you what it means to me. And so he bravely stood up, and at the ordination of Jared Sparks in Baltimore, he said, this is what Unitarian Christianity is. And he had really two reasons to do it. One was to explain and justify the different way of thinking that was reflected by this group of clergy, but it was also to insist that this group was still Christian. They were unwilling to be thrown out of the flock, because being self-identified as Christian was very important to them. So he insisted on defining Unitarian Christianity. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. He wasn't defining Unitarianism, he was defining Unitarian Christianity. So just a couple of brief excerpts here. He writes, there is no book that demands a more frequent exercise of reason than the Bible. Its style nowhere has the precision of science or the accuracy of definition. Its language is glowing, bold, and figurative, demanding more frequent departures from the literal sense than that of our own age and country, and thus demanding more continuous exercise of our judgment. We find that various portions of this book, instead of being confined to general truths, refer to the times that they were written, to the state of society then, to feelings and customs which have passed away, and without the knowledge of which we are in danger of extending to our time and place what was of temporary and local value. We find, too, that some of these books are strongly marked by the peculiarities of their writers, and that a knowledge of their feelings and of the circumstances in which they were placed is required for understanding their writing. We feel it our duty to exercise our reason, therefore, upon the Bible, to look beyond the letter to the spirit, to seek in the nature of the subject and the aim of the writer his true meaning, and in general to make use of what is known for explaining what is difficult and for discovering new truths. Now, I'm inviting you to try to imagine how heretical this is for the time. He's attacking orthodoxy. He's saying that this holy scripture is a guide rather than a writ, an authoritative writ, and that we need to look at it and interpret it, understanding how it applies to who we are today. And I love the part where he says about, you know, the writers that have their all their own peculiarities. So they all had agendas in there, and the folks that chose which books went into the Bible also had their agendas. I mean, because we know that there were an infinite number of books available out there which did not make it within the canon. So part of it is to look at that and think about that and ask ourselves why some of these things are included, some of them are excluded, and what they mean and what they might mean to us in our somewhat evolved current circumstances. So using reason. And he goes on to say, we grant that the use of reason in religion is accompanied with danger. But we ask any honest man to look back on the history of the church and say whether the renunciation of it is not more dangerous. The true inference from the almost endless errors which have darkened theology is not that we are to neglect and disparage our powers, but to exert them more patiently, carefully, and uprightly. The worst errors, after all, have sprung up in that church which excludes reason and demands from its members implicit faith. God has given us a rational nature and will call us to account for it. We may let it sleep, but we do so at our peril. It is the part of wisdom to take revelation as it is given to us and to interpret it by the help of reason, which it everywhere supposes and on which it is founded. So he's giving us all the invitation to be our own personal authorities, which is, I think, pretty much the essence of Unitarianism even today. We are our own personal authority, and we suffer the consequences if we don't diligently both practice it and watch over it. Mm-hmm. We don't want to become solipsistic and so self-absorbed that we can create a impractical and non-helpful religion. One of the hard things that I've discovered in 25 years of ministry is that there's so much freedom in our Unitarian congregations, but it's practiced as freedom from rather than freedom to. So many people reject other things, and so that we welcome feeling free, but then we don't accept the responsibility to actually create our own personal religion, whatever that is. So we have the freedom from orthodoxy, but we also have the freedom to create. And unfortunately, I discover way too many of us who don't take that second step. And we cherish so much being free from orthodoxy, but don't actually take the time and make the effort to create our own new religion. And he's warning about that back in 200 years ago. He goes also to say, we also think that the doctrine of the Trinity injures devotion, I love this, by taking from the Father the supreme affection and then transferring it to the Son. One of the basic premises of Christianity, of course, is the intercession of Jesus Christ. And the whole Unitarian, back to the 4th century, point is that we don't need that or want that intercession between us and our own personal experience and exposure and encounter with the divine, whatever that is. And so when we hold up this alternative character, it interferes with a more deeply and richer personal experience. That Jesus Christ, if exalted into the infinite divinity, should be more interesting than the Father is precisely what might be expected from history. Men want an object of worship like themselves, and the great secret of idolatry lies in this. A God clothed in our form and feeling our wants and sorrows speaks to our weak human nature more strongly than a Father in heaven. We believe that the worship of a bleeding, suffering God tends strongly to absorb the mind and draw it away from that greater object, just as the human tenderness of the Virgin Mary has given her so conspicuous a place in the devotions of the Catholic Church. We believe that this worship, though attractive, is not most fitted to spiritualize our minds. So he is willing to let go of this image of Jesus Christ. But I love the way he ends by reclaiming Jesus as prophet. We find that on no subject have men, and even good men, attached so many strange conceits, wild theories, and fictions of fantasy as on religion. And remembering, as we do, that we ourselves share the common weakness, we dare not assume infallibility in the treatment of our fellow Christians. We Unitarians have embraced our position not hastily or lightly, but after much deliberation, and we hold fast, not merely because we believe them to be true, but because we regard them as purifying that truth, as a teaching according to godliness, as able to work mightily to bring forth fruit to them who believe, that we wish to spread it. We have no desire to conceal, but we wish its diffusion because we regard it as more friendly to practical piety and pure morals than the opposite doctrines, because it recommends religion at once to the understanding of the heart, because it tends to restore the benevolent spirit of the prophet of Jesus to his divided and afflicted church. So he's taking on the Orthodox established order and saying this is what Unitarian Christianity is. And of course it goes on from there. Emerson graduated from Harvard in 18, shortly after that. And we know that the American Unitarian Association was founded in 1823, which was when all these sort of marginalized, liberal, progressive clergy decided to, we need to organize, and formed this this peer group, this support group for this marginalized free thinkers, and began to become more deliberate in explaining and defining and confronting much of the criticism. We know that another classic example is when Thomas Jefferson took his scissors to the Bible and he cut out the stuff he didn't agree with and he kept the stuff he did agree with. That's what Channing's talking about. And so the Unitarian controversy grew, and one of the lovely stories, there's a small town outside Boston called Dedham, and it's a classic New England town with a common, green, and there's a big old church at the top, the top of the common. It dates back to the 18th century, and it was one of these founding Unitarian New England churches, and it went through this controversy, and there were a group of people who disagreed, and they did not like this new liberal and progressive philosophy, so they decided to leave the church. They bought some property on the side of the common and built a new church, and it's still there. And it became the Second Congregational Church of Dedham. And they wanted the church silver. Every church had a communion set. Unitarian churches still did communion, not just flower communions and water communions, but the established church at the top of the hill was unwilling to give it up. So it went to the Massachusetts State Supreme Court. And the court came back and said, you are the majority of the people, that's true, but you left, so you don't get to take the silver. The silver stays with the original church. But it created such friction within the community and between these factions of people that the Unitarians boarded up the front of their church with the front doors, and they built a new entrance over on the side so that they could come to church and not look at this congregational church over on the corner. It was that vicious. It was that it was that much resentment. It was that much, you know, this whole notion of heresy was so alive and immediate in the community. And, you know, you can understand, we know that the Unitarians and the Universalists were anti-slavery and worked on a lot of things in the 19th century and civil rights in the 20th century and gay and lesbian rights. And I'm often amazed when people talk about same-sex marriages, which we've been doing for decades, and ordaining gay, lesbian, transgender people for decades. And it's almost like it's a non-issue for most of us. And unfortunately, though, what worries me a little bit is the vast majority of liberal religion has caught up with us. So we are not that much out on the fringes anymore. And I think we're becoming, as a denomination, a little bit complacent. We talk a good talk. We talk about standing on the side of love. We, you know, we make some statements. But where is the growing edge now that Channing had to face, and Emerson had to face, and Theodore Parker had to face? Where is that today for our denomination? And I'm feeling increasingly uncomfortable with our sense of self-righteousness and our, you know, we're good, we're right, we've got it right, and if everybody could just be more like us, and not understanding that there's still so much more work to do. I'm retiring next month, and I haven't yet figured out what I'm going to do. But the UUA did a self-examination a couple of years ago. It looked at class. And I'm becoming more aware, especially under the current administration, of the rift in our society, the growing rift of class and poverty and desperation. And here in Chestertown is a pretty nice little town. And yet we do know that there are people who live on the edge here. And I think it's going to become increasingly important for us to become uncomfortable with that and no longer be as complacent and enjoy the privilege that so many of us have. That's my concern is as our denomination continues to struggle. One of the points that recently, I don't know how many of you go to General Assembly, but it's not a policy that they're selling, but it's happens that there's conversations, a lot of conversations at lunch and at dinner around about changing the theology of Unitarianism to be more theistic so that we can welcome more people and become a larger denomination so that we can have more impact on the world. That frightens me, because then what happens to people like me who are a non-theist? And do we become something else because we want to have more people? And I'm not sure that's a good thing to do. I think that what we can do is be more active in looking at the injustices and working towards a better world and welcoming those people who want to be in that kind of an organization, regardless of their theology, because that's not about who we are. We have a little bit of time, hopefully, for some thoughts. I'm hoping that many of you were thinking as I was speaking, and might have some things to share, some thoughts to share.